Act 250, Vermont's land use law, is more than 50 years old. It's been a controversial piece of legislation for many years, as it tries to straddle the often competing demands of development versus land conservation. The legislature took a crack at updating and revising the sweeping legislation to reflect modern-day concerns in a bill known as S-234 during this past session. In essence, the proposed legislation would have revised the existing statute to make it easier for towns and cities to obtain incentives under Act 250, while exempting projects in certain municipalities located in so-called development areas. However, the bill was vetoed by Governor Phil Scott last May, who cited concerns that it would impede construction of new and much-needed housing. Backers of the bill argued it struck a balance between protecting forest blocks from being fragmented while easing the pathway for housing development in designated areas. On Thursday, August 11th, at 5:30 p.m. at the Arlington Common, a discussion about Act 250 will be held featuring Representative Amy Sheldon of Middlebury, the chairwoman of the House Natural Resources Committee, and Seth Bongartz, a member of the Natural Resources Committee and who was one of the architects of the legislation that eventually became S-234, the legislation vetoed by the governor. They will discuss proposals to reform land use regulations and land conservation, with questions and answers to follow. We had a chance to talk with Representative Bongartz recently about Act 250, about S-234, and where things possibly could be going in the wake of the governor's veto.
The goal was to try to make the Act 250 process be more functional. One of the criticisms right now is that the district commissions are issuing kind of, you get different outcomes depending on which commission you happen to be in front of. And part of the reason for that is that there really is no oversight. There's no effective oversight of the Act 250 process. So the district commissions, which are doing a good job and, you know, doing hard work, but there's no effective oversight. And the Natural Resources Board exists in name only. So part of what this was trying to do was put together a five-person professional board to hear Act 250 appeals, and then through that process really help guide the entire process, develop the drip lines with the umbrella so that the results would tend to be more uniform, do some really deep thinking, and as decisions are issued, really have them be decisions that kind of go into a little bit of the arena of policy and carefully setting precedent to help inform the next time something similar comes up. With the old environmental board, you had that happen with a lot of key cases that, incidentally, 30 years later are still the key cases that are being referred to when decisions are made. And so what's happened now with the process going to the environmental court rather than what we were calling the environmental review board is it's very removed from the average citizen, by the way. You know, going to court, somebody sitting in a robe on a bench, very different than being involved in a process with five people sitting at a table in a Grange Hall. This was kind of an effort to return Act 250, in part return it to its roots, but in doing so, really begin to develop a system for building expertise within that system and then providing guidance down to the district commission so that you'd really have a more uniform, functional process, which, and I believe deeply, would have benefited everybody. The other argument that I made in that op-ed is that I compared it to the 1960s when we had unregulated development, and especially in ski areas, and a lot of times in southern Vermont, where, you know, it was so unregulated that there was like raw sewage running across the ground. I mean, it was really just like, and that's where Act 250 came from. And we, because of that, we were able to keep Vermont from the resources to simply being exploited in the way that they've been exploited in most other states. And so we still have a pretty good natural resources base in Vermont. But right now the system is rudderless. And what we're going to have over the next, and we're seeing it now, we've begun to see it. We are going to be a climate haven. We already are a climate haven. And that's only going to become more acute as the conditions become worse in other parts of the country. So where we are now is that It's the 1960s again, except this time we have a little bit of a luxury of understanding that it's coming. We're going to have a lot of people moving here, especially because of the availability of the internet, the death of the office culture, or the whatever weakening of the office culture. And we're going to have pressures on the rural landscape that's going to have the potential is huge for sprawl to go on much more rapidly than it has been. And by way of example, and I made this point in the piece, we're losing 15,000 acres a year of forest land to development. And that's really, that is sprawl. And 15,000 acres, if you count just the perimeters of the football field, not the end zones, is 14,000 football fields a year of forest land being developed. That's obviously not sustainable. And what we should be doing instead is funneling that, making it much easier and really doing everything we can to encourage people to develop, especially housing in downtowns, in and around downtowns. Walkable cities don't need downtowns, don't need cars to drive everywhere. There are benefits from that are huge. They make towns more vibrant and they preserve the countryside. And so all of this goes together. And we were trying to, through all of the pieces, really trying to, A, make it easier, not dictate that housing be developed in and near downtowns, but make it easier to do that, encourage it, because there are so many advantages for everybody, including the people who would live there, and begin to and look harder at the issue of sprawl and development of Vermont's working landscape. And I think, you know, and so I think that the governor's veto of this bill is really tragic, frankly. But, you know, as always, there's next year, and we can go back at it. And we learned a few lessons from this round, and we're obviously going to try it again.
Again, the discussion about Act 250 will be held on Thursday, August 11th at 5:30 at the Arlington Common, which is located near the intersection of Route 313 West and Route 7A in Arlington. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Another event is returning after a two-year absence imposed by the COVID pandemic. The Vermont Community Leadership Summit is back. Scheduled for August 10th at the Vermont Technical College in Randolph, Vermont, the conference will explore a range of issues centering on local leadership and the challenges facing the state as the pandemic, though far from over, hopefully continues to ease, and questions facing communities, from housing, childcare, climate change, and racial equity, among others, present themselves. A wide-ranging agenda and 24 breakout sessions on a multitude of subjects are on offer, and over 500 community leaders from across the state are expected. The previous two summits, held in 2018 at Castleton University and in 2019 at the Vermont Technical College, attracted large numbers of attendees, and this year's conference will be another opportunity to network and hear from others. Jenna Koloski, the Council's Community Engagement and Policy Director, told us more.
So 2018 and 2019, we really wanted to bring folks together to focus on what do we need to foster leadership, local community leadership for the future of Vermont. You know, in our work, we're going around to communities all the time, and we're working with communities to help, you know, lead initiatives, bring folks together, select priorities. And what we see over time is the most critical element in those initiatives being successful are the local leaders who are willing to step up, take these things on. And we wanted to ask, you know, what do you need as local leaders to be more successful in your communities? And so these summits are designed to both provide workshops, educational opportunities, skills, peer networking and story sharing, but also an opportunity to hear from community leaders what's most important in their towns, what do they need to be successful, how can we best support leaders into the future. So we had sessions in 2018 and 2019. Coming back together in 2022, this remains a key priority for us. We're excited to bring folks back together. I think the structure of the agenda is similar, but some of the themes and issues, you know, things have changed in the last couple of years. Vermont has really seen a turning point in the things that communities are working on and thinking about. So we hope to really touch on those emerging issues as well. And then new this year, actually, we're building in a series of networking sessions. We have really heard from participants that they were looking for more like unstructured opportunities for just connecting with other leaders around the state. So we have three different times throughout the day where participants can come together, and we provide some structure for networking, but it's really a looser agenda to let people just connect, share what's going on in their town, and get to know each other. So those are the four types of things that people can expect, and they can pick and choose throughout the day what they want to attend.
How critical is the role of leadership in community resilience or building stronger communities or having communities that thrive as opposed to simply survive? I just wondered if your organization has sort of put together this conference focusing on leadership because of your perception that the role of leaders and community leaders really is vital in to make communities grow and prosper.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think that the role of local leaders is the key ingredient to success in Vermont communities. And that's exactly why it's actually why we hold this summit and why we have a Vermont Community Leadership Network where we offer workshops and skills and training. When we come out of a community facilitation with a community where they've set priorities, you know, those priorities, or even not working with us, when a community sets priorities, when they know that the direction that they want to take, if there aren't local volunteers, local leaders that step up to move those things forward, then those things just remain ideas that sit on the wall or, you know, sit in the town plan on the shelf and don't get, you know, taken, and they're not taken to that next step of implementation. You know, Vermont communities, our decision-making, our local government, our schools, you know, it relies on volunteers that are ready to step up and be those leaders. And so our focus is really, you know, knowing that to be true, how do we best provide those leaders with the resources they need, the skills they need? You know, in these small towns, capacity is a real challenge. There's no staff, there's no paid, you know, manager that's going to help to write grants and access resources. So we want to think about the ways that we can get those leaders that capacity and those skills that they need. So that's a lot of the focus of this summit is celebrating that leadership, but also thinking about how we can best support them, because I think it's key to the vitality of communities.
There's still time to register. Go to the council's website at vtrural.org for more information. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The state of Vermont's agricultural sector is one that pops up in the news frequently. Long an iconic part of Vermont's economy and identity, farming, both for dairy and crops, have struggled in recent years as the number of farms dwindles consistently from year to year. But at the same time, there are signs of new life in agriculture, from younger farmers entering the business, to organic farming and farmers markets, and a broadening of ways to generate income out of a farm setting. As it turns out, Open Farm Week is coming soon, from August 7th to the 14th. During the 2022 Vermont Open Farm Week, you can meet the farmers, plants, and animals that bring you your favorite high-quality Vermont food products.
So when the cows push the paddle, the milk or the water fills the bowl, and then as soon as they're done drinking, it drains back into the ground, 5 feet down, so it doesn't freeze. Yeah, they work really well.
The event is sponsored by Dig In VT, a project of the Vermont Agriculture and Culinary Tourism Council. But around the North Shire and in the nearby Medway Valley, you don't have to wait for Open Farm Week to check out local farms, several of which are opening themselves up for agritourism, or bed and breakfasts with a farming twist, or farm-to-table dinners, such as the one that took place Sunday, July 24th, at the Wayward Goose Farm in West Paulet. There, a farm-to-table dinner with a Spanish theme was hosted by the farm, which is owned by Dan and Laurie Brooks, who bought the farm in 2011 and have maintained a small herd of cows since then. They sell raw milk, veggies, and meat through their on-site farm store. We asked Dan Brooks to tell us a little bit more about how the farm-to-table dinners at the Wayward Goose Farm came to be.
We started in 2011. We had to do a lot of work on the barn to make it ready for animals and put a whole new floor in and a new gable end on the barn. And I did know a lot about cows and farming and didn't know that much about fixing up and starting a place from scratch, but we learned as we went. And yeah, but I came from a fifth-generation dairy farm and been in the family for years. We've diversified a bit and gotten a little more into raising a little more beef. We built our own little farm store, so we're trying to grow more of our own vegetables and potatoes and have a little market garden. But we also sell vegetables from other local organic growers and a lot of other producers from the area. We have stuff from their farms in our store as well.
So what gave you the idea to do these farm-to-table dinners? Is this the first year you've done them?
No, we had three of them before the pandemic and did them like in our backyard. We set up tables up there, but Lori had to do all of the cooking and all of the work, and we just decided it was too much work and not that enjoyable when she had to do all of that hard work. And meanwhile, our son opened this brewery in Brandon and had a chef that works with my other son-in-law at the Bosie's in Glens Falls. He runs the culinary program there, and so we got to know him a little bit and just talked about it and decided to try having a farm dinner in our haymow. And so that's how it came about, I guess.
And Lori Brooks is still involved, but more as an artist as opposed to being the cook.
So I did some original block prints, and each person gets one of the three. And the reason I chose to do these is because these are all animals. This is a muskrat, this is a possum, and this is a brown thrasher. And they have all, we've seen them, they live on the farm, all these animals, certain ones, so that's why I chose them.
Tonight, Chef Landell Eady was getting ready to serve a couple of dozen guests who had come for the farm-to-table dinner.
Yes, Dan and Lori has graciously invited me back. We got a trip to Spain, here in Vermont. We're going to be starting off with a lot of great, wonderful tapas, going into some nice farm salads, and finishing off with a great paella. There's just an abundance of great produce, local vendors right up the road and down the road with some wonderful meats and cheeses. And naturally, in my mind, I'm just like, you know, Dan and Lori have the most awesome chicken in the whole world. I'm like, why not put together a paella? Throw some wonderful produce and some seafood and some great chicken into one dish, bake it off, and there you go. I got to tell you, you just naturally feel a little bit better. I got some sweet onions that were like amazing. They weren't filled with not that much sulfur. Like, you didn't get any of that like burning in your chest. It was just sweet. Tomatoes that just tasted like a season, right? Tasted like spring and summer. And then the thing about it is you see the sweat. You see the equity that goes into farming, right? When you're working with somebody and that product is being shown when we're cooking tonight. So, yeah.
So are you going to be explaining to the audience or the people
yeah,
there
so,
what's
so
going to be going
what,
on?
What we do is we just kind of go through everything. Tonight, it'll probably go a little bit faster because we are battling a little bit of heat. And I don't want, you know, all of us to kind of bake out here. But we'll talk a lot about the food. We'll have a good time. We'll explain where certain dishes came from and how I interpreted it. Everything will be pretty authentic to Spanish cuisine, though.
Farming today requires some creativity and flexibility. The Wayward Goose, named for a blind goose named Oscar who wandered off and was found by the Brooks' daughter Margot when she was working at the nearby Consider Bardwell Farm, runs a farm store as well. In 2013, the Vermont Sustainable Agriculture Council named Wayward Goose Farm as the Farm of the Year. They pay close attention to environmental impacts of their work as well as treating their guests to a good meal. Oh, and the cows seem to be pretty friendly too. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Hildine, The Lincoln family home in Manchester is getting ready to start construction of a new $5.7 million, 14,000 square foot building that will house its special events, workshops, presentations, and weddings. It will replace the large tent located in between the original Hildean Mansion, built by Robert Todd Lincoln around the turn of the 20th century, and the Welcome Center. The new building will occupy basically the same location, but will be oriented slightly differently to minimize the impact of the view from the mansion. Weddings, one of the events that used to be held at least partially in the tent, will have to be moved up to the mansion and its courtyard for 2023. Almost all the needed permits are in place, with construction anticipated to start around November 1st. Brian Keefe, the president of Hildean, gave a presentation of the project at the Hildean Welcome Center on Wednesday, July 27th, where he described the project in detail.
Right now we have a tent that we use for our events in the summertime, primarily, mainly from late May till mid-October. We do a lot of weddings up there and other gatherings. But we have no space. This space, the Beckwith room we're in now, is the largest really space we have for public events, and it's really not that large. Even in the summertime, we can't really do programming because the tent can become very loud. It's hard to predict what the environment is going to be inside that tent on any given day, even in the summertime. But Lincoln Hall will allow us to do programming year-round and events year-round. So we'll be able to focus on some of our historic preservation efforts here, some of our pollinator sanctuary practices, some of our animal husbandry, some of our cheese making, the history of the Lincoln families, the civics lessons that come with that. There's a lot of programming that we can evolve around this building, drawing more people to Hildean, more people to the community, and be really a benefit to us and a benefit to the community. In addition, the other economic side of that coin is we can do more weddings in the summertime. By expanding the season, right now we can only, we put the tent up, as I said, late May to mid-October. We can broaden those shoulder seasons, and that helps our bottom line here. This building will enhance our guest experience as well. We'll be creating a courtyard atmosphere just to the east of the Welcome Center, in a courtyard that's going to be bordered by the Welcome Center, the Pavilion Building, and Lincoln Hall. Lincoln Hall on this side will be a two-story building. We have an undercroft, there'll be a couple conference rooms, but for the day guests, there'll be ADA accessible bathrooms, and we'll be able to provide food service in the form of food service through a window for people to grab and go and sit down and be comfortable and extend their stay comfortably here at Hildean. Food service is also something that we've long yearned for, and we're looking forward to having that amenity for our guests. We plan to commence construction November 1st. It will begin with some site work. We're going to be removing the building that's up there now that houses the kitchens and bathrooms. There will be blasting that will be required to get the site prepared for building up from there. So this fall there will be demolition and blasting and construction. This is a big project for us, and it's relatively big for this area. And so that will be disruptive in the fall, and then it's going to be about 18 months of construction, so there will be a lot of activity there. We're trying to plan carefully so that it's as least disruptive as possible to our day guests. Although it's right in the middle of our campus, and so you're not going to be able to avoid all the impacts. We will manage through that. We plan to be completed by middle of May in 2024. So that we have the wedding season 2024 will be, the weddings will be, reception will be in this building as opposed to the tent. The tent after this year will be no more. Correct. We won't be able to do weddings of the scale that we've done in the past. We are working on an ability to do smaller events that would be up in the formal gardens, but that site where the tent is now is totally unavailable. So if you're interested in some kind of an event in 2023 of a smaller scale, you can give us a call, Dr. Carmine Cole. But the large, you know, our weddings, how many this year, Carmine?
38
this year, and they probably average 140, 150. We had one that was 226. Anything of that scale we can't do. And the main reason is, of course, the gardens are beautiful all year round, especially during peony season in early June. So the garden area and that terrace is a beautiful place for an outdoor event. And so the weddings are typically, people love them, and other gatherings people love. But if we're planning for something, we need to have cover when there's bad weather. And the most we can do is probably 50 people or so up there.
The capacity of the new Lincoln Hall building is reckoned to be about 220 people. Construction of the new Lincoln Hall is expected to be complete by May of 2024. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.